Fred and
Joe. Then on the Crescent himself.
One second, they can't. For some reason, they're not registering
that. Is that right? Barbara, moderator for Anchorage. Do you hear me? Over.
Yes, Senator.
Okay.
We got it.
No, okay, I just need to lose connection there.
All right. Barbara, is General Nekrasin there? Over.
Yes, he is.
Ask the General if he would like to testify. If so, please go ahead. Over.
Thank you very much, Senator Bradley, and members of your committee for giving me this opportunity to testify before your committee on the two proposals that the Department of Military Affairs has submitted in this session of the legislature. Both of these proposals are extremely important to the continued maintenance of the high strength level that we currently enjoy in both the Army and the Air National Guard. The retention of trained and qualified members is my number one concern. Alaska leads the nation in state-funded incentives for continuing participation in the Guard, and these new proposals will ensure even better retention in the years to come. Now, addressing Senate Bill 404 first. Present law gives retired members $50 per month for each month served in the Alaska National Guard or Naval Militia, but only if they are an active member upon reaching age 55 and have served 20 years in the Guard. If a member dies before the total eligibility has been paid, the payments stop. The new proposal eliminates the age 55 requirement. It allows credit for service in all branches of the armed services, raises the retirement pay to $100 per month for each month of service, and provides for a final lump sum payment to a beneficiary in case of the member's death. We feel that raising the amount to $100 is keeping pace with other programs. By eliminating the age 55 requirement, we are affording members a choice to retire earlier, but the $100 per month is not large enough to prompt retirement. The survivor's benefit will help include the family and guard decisions and promote longer service with the state, and allowing other prior service to count for retirement eligibility will encourage more veterans to join and stay with the Guard. I conclude my statement on Senate Bill 404. Are there any questions?
Any questions by the membership of General Nekrasin?
Yeah, I've got one.
Senator Kelly.
General Nekrasin, we have a letter here from Paul Arnold, Director of the Division of Retirements, and he wants to, he suggests that we come in with a totally different Alaska National Guard retirement system and have the Department of Military Affairs funded. He's concerned about the funding down the road of this pension system. Has there been any discussion in the Guard ranks regarding this approach, and if so, what's your position on this?
I'm not acquainted with the subject of the bill, sir, and I would like to see it. Before I comment on that, I do have Colonel Compton here with me. He may have some information. He shakes his head no. We would both like to see it before we make a comment on it.
No, you're on the right bill.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Very well, General. Thank you very much. We'll hold that for a while and see who else has to testify and come back to that.
All right, sir. This is General Nekrasin again on Senate Bill 405. Senate Bill 405 is designed to pay a bonus in the total amount of $3,000 for the first 6-year re-enlistment only. This would be paid in three payments of $1,000 each. The first payment would be made at the end of the second year, the second at the end of the fourth year, and the last payment at the end of the sixth year. The program is designed to give the younger members a sum of money large enough to make it meaningful to remain in the Guard. By the time the member completes this reenlistment, he or she will have made up their mind as to whether or not to make a career of the Guard. And the retirement program, as proposed in Senate Bill 404, will provide the continuing incentive. Of course, those people who are not on their first reenlistment will continue to receive bonus of the present received for the current statute.
Thank you, either.
Yes, we are.
There was much noise on the line. We didn't hear the last part of this statement. Possibly you could repeat it?
Yes, 1 minute.
Okay. All right, this is Joe McClassen again. I'll repeat the last half of my testimony on Senate Bill 405. The program in Senate Bill 405 is designed to give the younger member a sum of money large enough to make it meaningful to remain in the Guard. By the time the member completes this reenlistment, he or she will have made up their mind as to whether to make a career of the Guard, and the retirement program as proposed in Senate Bill 404 will provide the continuing incentive. Of course, those members that are currently in the Guard, not on their first reenlistment, will continue to receive the bonus authorized under current statute. That concludes my testimony on Senate Bill 405.
Thank you very much, General. Sorry to have to repeat the last portion of your testimony, but we had a little static on the line. Are there any questions from the membership for General McClassen? Senator Kelly.
General, on line 24, persons who have a break in service of more than 30 days forfeit their eligibility for a retirement bonus, reenlistment bonus. If I remember correctly, a large number of National Guardsmen get out for 2 or 3 months, might not be in the Guard, might go fishing, come back in the winter and want to re-up. Why do we have this section in here? Why is it necessary to have that break in service ineligibility section?
I'm sorry, they didn't give any of that. There's something.
Now I got to do all that again?
I'm really sorry.
Barbara, moderator at the Anchorage Network, we'll have a brief recess here until we get things squared away. Is something wrong?
Thank you. We'll be here.
Our Fred?
Yes.
Is there any reason for these things to be sticking straight up like that?
Just to be pushed back out of the way because I set this up earlier today.
Yeah, you might want to turn those down a little less.
That's what Arnold in this letter is suggesting.
Can they hear me now?
Bill, I think we're about through this one. We'll take you out.
Why don't you try it? Yeah.
Am I coming through in Anchorage?
Yes, you are.
Comes and goes.
Okay, General, this is Senator Kelly again on Section B of 405. Persons who have a break in service of more than 30 days forfeit their eligibility for a reenlistment bonus. If I remember from my old days in the Guard, there are a great number of people got out for 2 or 3 months or 6 months and then decided to go back into the Guard. And I'm just wondering why we're disallowing these kinds of people the reenlistment bonus.
Senator Kelly, this is General McClassen. I'm going to ask Colonel Compton to answer that question. Colonel Compton.
This is Colonel Compton, Senator Kelly.
We feel that a continuous service is the very best possible career for both the guard and the individual. And if someone actually was going to be away for a few months, they could ask for leave. It's not a big point to us. We just like the uniformity of re-enlistment.
Any further questions of the membership of General McCrassen or Compton?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Sturgalusky.
Yes, General, we have in our packet on SB 404 and 405 information from Paul Arnold, the Director of Retirement and Benefits, calling for a National Guard retirement system to be set up that would act much like the PERS TRS system. How much investigation has been done on that, and what is your position?
This is Senator, this is the first time we, either General McCrassen or myself, had heard of this proposal. We would like to study it and then comment later on it, if we may.
Mr. Chairman, to continue if I might, is it my understanding that this bill by the governor has the governor's support and a fiscal note to totally fund it as of today of $124,000? Is that correct? That's 404?
Yes, that is correct. The year funding in our fiscal note submitted in on the 20th of December indicates for fiscal year 81. 124.2, and it has the complete support of the governor.
Thank you.
General McCrassen, Mr. Compton, we're having the letter from the Department of Administration, Retirements and Survivor Benefits Division telecopied down to you at present. I don't know if you'll get it in time today or not, but in case you do, if anyone's standing by, we might refer to it again before we adjourn today. If not, we'll carry it over to the next meeting.
That'll be fine, Senator Bradley. We'll monitor the telex in our office, and if possible, we will comment on it today.
Very well. I see it's dated March 7th, but we just got it, I think it was yesterday, and we didn't have time to consider it and get it to you.
Yes, well, we'll be ready to comment if it arrives in time today.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, sir.
Senator Sturgalusky.
I would be most appreciative if, in connection, before this bill moves forward, if we could have some testimony on that specific request and, you know, certainly by the department, because it may have some bearing as to whether that's feasible after, if we go ahead and act on this and don't take a look at the other, we may be barring ourselves from that kind of action. So thank you very much.
I certainly agree, Senator Sturgalusky. I don't think we could possibly do it any other way. Do we have anybody here from Mr. Arnold's our division? Wonder what happened now. Well, I don't think we could properly pass out the bill without testimony from that division. We have Mr. Dick Roundtree here. It says for questions only. Dick, do you have any statements you want to make or answers to questions already asked?
I think at this time I will withhold any further testimony until we have a copy of Mr. Roundtree's position paper.
Thank you very much, Dick, and we'll notify you for the next meeting. Now we'll take up what's the number? Senate Joint Resolution 49. That's the Mexican consul in Anchorage.
Si.
Senator Sumner.
Interesting.
I'm surprised they don't already have one.
Si.
In Spanish.
Buenos dias, amigos.
Señor Senator.
Mr. Chairman. Muy poquito.
Keep this serious.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. It came as a surprise to me, and maybe it will to you, that we have in the state of Alaska approximately 10,000 people from the Hispanic community. I didn't realize the numbers were that high. It also was interesting to me to find out that there is very close communication between the citizens of Alaska that are represented in the Hispanic community, and that they, some of the unique problems that they have, I confess that I was not originally aware of, or no one had brought them to my attention. But basically, many of the people within the family may speak Spanish as a primary language. They have relatives throughout the South 48 and Mexico, and as a matter of fact, all over the United States. And they find it difficult from time to time trying to solve some of the problems that they encounter. One of the major problems that I understand that they have that no other community has expressed to me is that from time to time as they travel, they're harassed by customs people say, let me see your papers, even though they may have been born here, lived here all their life. And it's quite, it's a common problem among many of the people of our community. They felt that if they had a consul here, that they would enjoy better communication liaison with their mother country and their people, their relatives and friends from there. They're enthusiastic for the bill. I would hope the committee could see a particular advantage to Alaska to have this. It's no cost to the state, and at least personally, I intend to keep following up, assuming we get favorable or passage on this resolution, to continue to follow the Mexican government to see if we can't bring this about. So it's a serious effort on my part, one that I hope and intend to follow through with. I know that Senator Kelly is also a very strong advocate and supporter and enjoys excellent support out of this community as well. I thank you.
Thank you, Senator Sumner. Any questions for Senator Sumner? Thank you very much, Senator Sumner. Rather than go down the list of networks, let me call all at once, conference call, I suppose you'd call it. Does anyone at any network prefer to testify in regard to this Senate joint resolution concerning the Mexican consul in Anchorage? I assume not.
I'd move Nash unanimous consent that we pass our Senate Joint Resolution 49 with individual recommendations.
Any objections?
I'll be a new pass.
I'll be a new pass.
I want to change that to a new pass.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Senator Sumner. The next bill we'll take up is our Senate Bill 64. And we have our, anybody in any bigger hurry than someone else? If not, Howard Ryder or Rolla? Oh, hi, Howard. Yeah, I haven't seen you since last session.
Chairman, Senators, I'm Howie Ryder. I'm here representing Lyle Cardwell Furniture. I'm the General Manager of the outfit. I wish to speak in favor of Senate Resolution 64. Not only is the inventory tax a very regressive tax, but I feel personally that it works to a detriment to both the business person and the general public. It's a very onerous from a business standpoint to be taxed for trying to carry an inventory of goods that people want to buy for trying to do a good job. So we are faced with either the solution of cutting down inventory at the time you take your inventory to lower your tax, or carrying an inventory as you always would and paying a rather large tax. If you cut it down, the public comes in to buy goods. You don't have them the good share of the time. It's puts a hardship on them because without the number of stores in here in Alaska that we have down south, they don't have other places to go. So I think it is vital, personally, that in a state like Alaska, where our lag time from ordering to receipt is so long, I think it's a very vital thing that we have a large inventory to try and serve the public. And the way the bill is not, or the way the inventory tax is, the harder you work and the more money you spend to do a good job, the more they tax you for doing it. In our particular case, we carry hardware, housewares, appliances, furniture. And on hardware, housewares, and appliances, if we let our inventory go down, our receipt of new merchandise after order will vary anywhere from 3 to 9 weeks. On furniture, our inventory will vary anywhere from 2 to 7 or 8 months. And it becomes an extremely difficult thing to try to work in there. And I've always felt this way about it, and advocated rescinding that tax for a good number of years. Our business, just an example, exclusive of furnishings, just inventory alone, had a direct tax at the end of 1979 of $5,659.68 that comes right out of the old profit column. And there's just nothing else you can do about it. But we have to do a store that does not cut back on our inventory. It's customer service, as well as the fact that when you lose a sale, you lose money there also. So it's a part of the question of damn if you do and damn if you don't situation.
Mm-hmm. That's what I would say. Any questions for Mr. Wilder? Thank you very much, Howard. Let's take a brief recess here. I'll confer with one of the members of the committee on a point. We'll take the rest of the testimony on Senate Bill 64. Don Koch?
Yes, sir.
There you are, Don.
My name is Don Koch, and I'm not here representing the state today.
Good, Don.
I'm on annual leave. I have a small business. I'm a photographer, and I sell photographs, people pictures, scenery pictures, whatever I can, whatever people seem to like. I sell. I also do some custom printing. I will do portrait work and things of this nature. My business is really, really small peanuts, and it's just starting. I would expect this year I'll probably get into the profit column, hopefully. I have what amounts to a fairly capital-intensive business. I've presently got something on the order of $15,000 invested in equipment and inventory. I would say approximately 20% of my investment is inventory. If you're selling photographic prints, artistic prints primarily, you have to have a fairly good stock on hand. Last year I had to pay a tax on my equipment and inventory, amounting to roughly $185. Now that sounds small, but when you consider I'm really in kind of the startup phase and I only grossed about $1,000, and all my expenses had to come out of that, that tax is a pretty heavy burden. Consequently, I do support this bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions. Just thought maybe you might like to hear from small people.
I've been one of them. That's one reason I introduced the bill, Don. I paid it, and I thought it was a very unfair, regressive tax myself. Any questions from the membership? Well, I'll just add one more thing. Somebody permanently borrowed my raincoat and hat here a year before last, and it was raining almost every day. I had to go all the way to Anchorage to get one because everybody said, well, we did have some your size, but we don't anymore. The mall, you know, the airport, Mendenhall, here, everywhere. And so the individual, the retailer sells less, and the consumer is handicapped too. That's bad.
It
okay, thank you.
Maintain adequate stock, but when you know that you're going to have to pay a tax on it, whether you make a profit off it or not.
Thank you very much. One point. Don, Senator Kelly.
You know where that really comes into play is with the auto part inventories. You ever try to get an auto part up here in Alaska and they'll say, well, we just won't stock it because we have to tax it?
Yes, that's very true.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Sturgalusky.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, there are representatives in the audience, I don't know if they wish to testify or not, from community and regional affairs, the Deputy Commissioner Marie Finielberry is here. I want to point out for the record, I came to this meeting today and I was not hadn't had time to do all of my homework on the bill that's before us. I have in community and regional affairs SB 510, on which we've done a certain amount of work, and I need to point out that this bill, and I have a lot of sympathy for it, the municipalities are able to have the option whether to tax for this or to exempt for it. Certain areas, for instance, Fairbanks and Kenai, in their structure of tax, have exempted business inventory tax, and obviously they're spreading their tax load in a different way. That, if they were to reimpose that tax, would generate for those two communities somewhere in the neighborhood of $3 million. There are a number of municipalities, some 13, who raise some $9 million on this particular form of a tax. And Anchorage, for instance, raises over $7.5 million. The bill that's in my committee does allow for, say that the state will return those dollars to the municipality, whether or not that is a realistic approach, because it would obviously mean some kind of a probably annual appropriation or not, is another question. I have a lot of sympathy for this bill, but I also have a lot of sympathy for the municipalities who would stand to lose this particular thing if we acted on the state level. You know, it may be that you'd want this bill to go forward to finance for complete discussion on it. That's up to the leadership of the chair, but I feel it's only appropriate that I bring it out, and as has been pointed out by the gentleman that testified there, they have interest, and there's been a lot of interest that has been generated on this issue, and I know I have correspondence from people saying that they're concerned about the would like to see the elimination of the tax.
Senator Sturgalusky, what do you have there in the way of revenue that would be lost in Juneau?
Juneau shows $227,000.
Right.
That's the 1980 revenue projection.
I hear from good source we're going to increase the revenue sharing this year, but you never know to most of the municipalities what it'll be used for. I presently have a bill that's earmarked just for the reduction of property taxes. It's in preparation now. It should be out
a couple of days.
And we put a lot of work in on that. And I know the municipalities don't like to go to the state and beg for money. They like to make sure they're going to get it. So I'm aware of that. And I've already consulted with my area, Mayor George Sullivan. And, of course, they don't like it, but they'd like to get it back one way or the other. And that's only understood. So I think what I'll do is we'll pass this on out today. Somebody will make a motion to finance. Meantime, I'll coordinate with my back home mayor once again, since this was last year when I did it before, and see if I can't work out something with him and with finance, either make some amendments or send it out like it is. We'll just go ahead and take the rest of the testimony in the meantime, because it's a bad tax. I think we all know that it had been in bad business. So now let us, with that explanation, let us take our... Should we take the lady first, Dave?
Sure, please.
Susan? Suzanne Jansen.
Suzanne Jansen, I have a small business also. Framing art gallery. I feel that the tax is very inequitable. It's also very antiquated for today's day and times. I can sympathize with the municipalities, but I think that it's time that somebody started sympathizing with the small businessman. It seems that whenever we try to get a little extra funds or whatever, everybody comes to the small businessman. We are hit constantly with organizations wanting donations for this, donations for that. I'm sure that throughout the year, although my personal property tax is not that large, because I make a very strong point of bringing my inventory down at the end of the year, which is a real shame, because then my customers suffer until about March, because our suppliers are hit trying to bring everybody's inventories back up. Needless to say, I'm sure that throughout the year, in donations alone to organizations, etc., that I'm sure that I probably put out that much again to worthy causes. And there has to be some relief, one way or the other. I feel that the state of Alaska at this time is, this is just another one of these, another group that is saying, you know, you have the money. We are another group that has our hands out, but I think that we are a very deserving group, because after all, we are the backbone of not only the country, but very important to the state of Alaska. And that's all I have to say.
Thank you very much, Suzanne. Any questions? No questions. Mr. Dave Freeman?
All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Senators. My name is Dave Freeman, and I'm representing the General Chamber of Commerce. The subject of the inventory tax has been with us for many, many years, and we've tried to find solutions to resolve it. We've been able to get as far as the municipality and their fears of replacement of revenue, and certainly that's a concern of ours. I did enjoy hearing that there was another effort being made that perhaps would rebate the revenue back to the municipalities and portion of what was lost. But to add another perspective to the bill, a lot of people have referred to the tax as a small tax, which it is. The smaller the business, the lower the tax. But it's interesting to note that in Juneau's case, the net profit to the owners that is required to pay that tax represents the net profit of about $5 million worth of sales. So where the percentage figures are small on a piece of paper, we're talking about a lot of gross revenue to generate enough net profit to pay what Juneau's share of that tax would be. I think that's a point that perhaps has been missed a little bit, especially in our dealing with the municipalities. We are impacted here in many, many ways. We have large mail order operations competing with local inventories, and there's quite an inequity there. We have one particular company that deals with heavy machinery where a small crankshaft for an engine is valued at $3,000. They don't like to leave the mail laying around, yet when they need them, they've got to dredge them to the lower 48. Results in a lot of downtime. So I think you'll have a lot of sympathy with the business community on this. In fact, rarely do we find anybody that speaks out against it. The revenue replacement seems to be the big thing.
Mr. Chairman.
Senate Bill 510 may eliminate part of that problem. Thank you for the opportunity.
Senator Stargluski.
Dave, have you attempted to work over the years with the municipality of Juneau, city and borough of Juneau, to try and get redistribution of that tax load? In other words, areas can exempt themselves from it. Have you used that approach?
I personally am aware of about 7 years of effort with the city and borough, and they agree with us, and we have a lot of sympathy there. We've never been able to come to an agreement as to how it should be replaced. The last figure I had, it's about 3 years old, we needed to replace about $180,000 of lost revenue.
It's up now to over $225,000.
Right, I was interested to hear your new figures. They're hamstrung because it has to come out of somebody's pocket. That represents a substantial impact on the local millage rate, and it raises havoc on the collected through sales tax. So they agree with us, we agree with them. And we felt maybe it was the Assembly's responsibility to come up with a replacement, and they're looking for some help from us.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dave. Our Marie, do you care to testify?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We didn't plan to testify today. We wanted to listen to the testimony, but we wouldn't answer questions if we want.
Very well.
And I'm Steve Van Zandt from our local government assistance division here.
Very well. Does anyone at this time have any questions for anyone from the Community and Regional Affairs Department? I guess not. We still have people signing up on the sign-in sheet. Is there anyone else to testify for Senate Joint Resolution 64? I didn't think so.
Senator?
What? All right. Is there anyone at any of the networks? And who is on the line at present, Owen?
Yes, this is Barbara in Anchorage. And Tom Puffnock would like to speak to Senate Bill 64.
Very well, Barbara. Go ahead, Tom. Over.
Good afternoon, Senator. In my dealings with retail outlets and retail businesses in the last 4 years as an accountant in this state, I find that one of the biggest burdens that any retail business has to face is the economic ordering of shipments from the lower 48. This particular tax prevents large orders because large orders imply large inventories. I think that to eliminate this tax totally on a state level, forcing the municipalities to eliminate it, will create a benefit to the entire business community. It would stimulate more warehouses being built up here. It would stimulate more jobs in those warehouses. It would stimulate more sales because there would be a better selection of inventory on hand. This increase in sales for those areas that have a sales tax would offset the revenue lost to the municipalities in this tax. And it would strike a blow for Alaskans to separate ourselves from Seattle warehouses. And I support the idea, too, that this increased inventory that we would have available to the business community would increase our productivity. We wouldn't have so much downtime and awaiting orders for parts. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Tom. Nice hearing your voice. I'll see you Saturday at the board meeting. Do we have anybody else, Barbara and Anchorage, to testify on Senate Joint Resolution, Senate Bill 64?
No, Senator, we do not.
Do we have one in any other network that wishes to testify on Senate Bill 64? I assume not.
Motion. Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, I would move the bill out of committee with individual recommendations.
I'm Jack.
Jack?
I'm Jack. Mr. Chairman.
Yes. Senator Ferguson.
Mr. Chairman, this bill was written up without a provision to reimburse the municipalities, and I think that although it was the state that gave the authority to the municipalities to tax, it's the legislature that's doing this, and it's the state's responsibility, so I'd like to see an amendment on there that would provide for reimbursement.
Senator Ferguson, since we've got this 1 April deadline, this is what we discussed, I think, while you were absent. We're going to do just that, but just got to go to CRNA and finance, and by 1 April, we don't know if we can make that deadline. But it probably won't go any further until we do make such arrangements. That's satisfactory to you.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Stagliska.
This bill can move forward, but I can't support it because I don't think we've addressed the problem of the municipalities, and it's not, they have no, they just don't have a source to it. This is a bad tax, and maybe there's a way of, finding an answer to it, okay?
Well, what they will probably do is raise your property taxes or some other means. They're going to get it one way or another.
They might even spend less.
Yeah, they might even spend less is exactly what I was thinking. I'm tired of being taxed.
Mr. Chairman,
anyway.
Just a response to that, if we don't spend lots of capital dollars so they're forced into operational costs, why, maybe they can.
They'll probably count on my bill for increasing the revenue sharing, specifically for reduction of property taxes. That's a good bill. We put a lot of time in it. It's about ready now. Do we have anyone else to testify on this bill? I don't think we do. Before we We've already had the motion. I'm sorry. Okay, we'll take up our Senate Bill 346 next. Do we have anyone at any of the networks that might be in a very big hurry that would like to testify first? Any network? Over.
Do you have any preference?
Which one are we on?
Senate Bill 346. Do we have Mr. Bob Blake here? Bob?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Bob Blake. I'm currently president of the United Fishermen of Alaska, the Cordova Aquatic Marketing Association, and chairman of the Cordova District Fisheries Union. I'm here today before you to testify in support of Senate Bill 346, which, as you know, is a bill that would require the Department of Revenue to compute and report the average wholesale prices for Alaska canned salmon. The amendment Senate Bill 346 addresses prior to 1979 has been a statutory requirement of the Department of Revenue and the Alaska Salmon Canada, and for many, many years. It does not call for increasing the bureaucracy or for a new budgetary program or inflict any additional cost to the state of Alaska or the canning industry that hasn't been required previously. It merely calls for the continuation of a process that has been recognized as the most credible means of assessing the value of Alaska canned salmon for a given year. Now, last year, when the state amended the raw fish tax, one of the things that was overlooked was that it repealed the first five sections of the existing statutes at that time. And the first section of those statutes was what Senate Bill 346 addresses. And that is the reason why we are coming back in and asking for this piece of legislation. The Alaska wholesale average values for canned salmon are the only source of information available or obtainable at any cost that are recognized and accepted by processors and fishermen as a credible base to negotiate ex-vessel prices. It was argued by a member of the House Resource Committee that House Bill 773 and Senate Bill 346 was a special interest piece of legislation simply because my Cordova organization requested its introduction. I certainly admit that we do have a special interest in this bill because it has provided the basis from which we've negotiated marketing agreements with Prince William Sound processors for the past 15 years, and we definitely desire to continue that practice. However, it is totally erroneous to label Senate Bill 346 special interest unless it is felt that the interest of the statewide fishing industry and processing industry and the economy of the state of Alaska is a special interest. Bristol Bay, Sandpoint, Kodiak, Prince William Sound have all in the past negotiated deferred payment type contracts, or sliding scale contracts, if you will. And these contracts are totally dependent on Alaska wholesale average figures. Cook Inlet and Southeastern ex-vessel prices are directly related to those settlements. And even when they have contracts that are not sliding scale, the canned product values are negotiated from Alaska wholesale average figures. We are consciously concerned with the large runs expected in Bristol Bay this coming season. The impact of those runs and the price settlement there is going to affect the entire salmon industry of Alaska, Canada, and the West Coast, as well as literally every resident of Alaska. Those runs will govern the market conditions and the price of salmon for several.
And we're in our committee.
How's it going, Bob?
Okay, with the vast majority of Alaskan salmon production being canned, it's imperative that there's a guaranteed database available to work from for a fair and equitable ex-vessel price settlement and a fair and equitable tax revenue to the state. It must be noted that the two price offers for Bristol Bay salmon that have surfaced to date utilize canned salmon prices as a base. There are strong indications that future negotiations will follow the same line. If the Alaska wholesale average is not guaranteed by statute in the very near future, it will drastically curtail the ability of the involved parties to reach an equitable settlement. The spin-off from that will affect the statewide industry and the state itself. There are no other means by which to obtain the information provided by the Alaska Wholesale Average. The National Marine Fisheries Service Pink Sheet, which gives the weekly canned value or values of canned salmon, is not acceptable to salmon canners as a qualified source. It can only be used for an indicator of market conditions and not a fact sheet. The Department of Revenue is considering contracting with the National Marine Fisheries Service to produce similar figures to those disclosed by the Alaska Wholesale Average, now that they are not required to compile them themselves. Therefore, the cost to the state, if this arrangement is pursued, is going to continue and probably increase. However, the inability of National Marine Fisheries Service to obtain all the information necessary will result in only a glorified pink sheet with no credibility at all. A quick phone call to Mr. John Bishop, who compiles the information for the pink sheet, will tell you exactly that. Unless the legislature wishes to change the confidentiality statutes that are now on the books, no one but the Department of Revenue is in a position to produce these values. My organization had a sliding scale contract for pink salmon in 1979, and we hired a very reputable and capable consulting firm to develop a projected 1980 Alaska wholesale average in the event that we might have to use it to reach a final settlement for our contract. To arrive at the 1980 Alaska wholesale average figures, we required the firm to correlate past 10 years Alaska wholesale average figures with the past 10 years pink sheet average figures for the months of August through December. And based on a percentage of relativity, utilizing the 1979 August through December pink sheet averages, the firm projected our 1980 Alaska wholesale average. Well, it looks impressive, and it is impressive, and statistically it is sound, but it lacks the most important factors necessary to give it judicial credibility. It lacks the ability to weigh the pink sheet monthly averages with the volumes of sales, because those figures aren't obtainable from any other source. And it lacks the ability to accurately project the promotion discount and things of that nature that only the processors have access to. These lacking factors can only be provided for by the processors themselves, and no one else can obtain them. Without those key missing links, it's impossible to even buy credible, acceptable database. The cost to the processor incurred in reporting to the Department of Revenue had been referred to as a significant factor. In fact, at one place, $100,000 was thrown out. Well, any major processor has an accounting staff and certainly keeps tabs on what they sell their salmon for. And I seriously doubt if any major processor can attribute more than one day's time for one person to computing and compiling the report that's necessary. I have copies of that form if you don't have them available. It's a simple one-page sheet. As far as a small operator goes, my wife runs a mom-and-pop cannery in Cordova. It takes her at the most 10 minutes to fill hers out. So it's hard to attribute a direct cost, you know, to a lot of the people that we're talking about, and an insignificant cost at most to any of the others. I honestly feel that any processor that opposes this bill is more concerned with other potential costs and not with the cost of reporting the information. Conversely, the ability to negotiate a deferred payment or sliding scale contract based on Alaska wholesale average figures represents a tremendous savings in interest dollars for the processors. For example, our 1979 pink salmon, our Prince William Sound pink salmon contract, if projected at current interest rates, saved the processors in Prince William Sound approximately $595,520 in interest for that one contract, for that one species in 1979. And it also gives the processor the opportunity to actually sell a major portion of their pack if they have this type of contract before they fully pay for the resource, or for the ex-vessel price. To answer the question, who uses the Alaska wholesale average figures? The answer is simple. Every resident of the state of Alaska uses those figures, either directly or indirectly. The fishing industry is dependent on those figures to arrive at a fair and equitable price settlement. The state of Alaska is dependent upon that fair and equitable price settlement to in turn receive a fair and equitable return through the raw fish tax, which are a percentage of that settlement. The raw fish tax revenue from the 1979 season exceeded the cost to the state of the entire budget of the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, including vessels, game, sport, commercial, fish, FRED, Fish and Wildlife Protection, by $20 million. Even if some residents didn't derive a direct benefit from fish and game management, they did derive a benefit from the general fund. Unquestionably, though possibly indirectly, every resident of the state benefits from having the state continue to compile and compute the Alaska wholesale average for canned salmon. We know all too well the necessity of a timely settlement in Bristol Bay, especially this year. Any impediment which keeps that from happening is not in the best interest of the state, and the key tool for that price settlement is the guarantee of the Alaska wholesale average figures. Therefore, Senate Bill 346 and House Bill 773 must pass through the legislature, and they must pass now. I wish to thank you for this opportunity to appear before you, and I hope that we inform you to some degree on the merits of the bill.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Staglewski.
Yes, a couple of points. It was brought out in some testimony, written testimony from the departments. A couple of things, and I'd appreciate your comment. One is that there's no penalty for failure to report, and it really, unless there's some follow-up and enforcement, I'm just wondering if people, since it's not based on their having to pay a tax, but just to supply information, whether we would continue to receive accurate and up-to-date information.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Ferguson.
To Senator Staglewski. Committee substitute for House Bill number 773 does make that change in it, and my recommendation would be that we, should we pass this bill out, or attempt to would be to amend that
to take care with that. All right.
Yes.
I think that's important. Then the other question that was raised, and I don't have enough knowledge of the problem. I can understand this problem. It says, why are we limiting this to canned salmon? Are there other things where this information might be a benefit, or is this too narrow, the legislation?
There, I would prefer that Mr. Dawson answer that question. There are some things, excuse me, I'm sorry.
That's all right, Bob. I was going to ask that same question. And in regard to Senator Ferguson's question, from line 6 to through 17 of page 2 of the House bill is what I think that Mr. Dawson would recommend that we add to the bill. Any further questions for Mr. Blake? Thank you very much, Bob.
Mr. Chairman, do one more thought.
Sure.
One of the things that, has been brought up in the past is that this information is required by the Department of Fish and Game in an annual report, and this fits into what Mr. Dawson certainly will tell you. But just to show the difference between the Department of Fish and Game requiring by regulation these figures, for the moment, the Alaska wholesale average figures, primarily. The Department of Fish and Game still does not have, you know, at this date, over 50% of their funds that are required by regulation turned in, and they are going to have to use Department of Public Safety to go after those. The Department of Revenue this year, because we have had a pink salmon contract based on Alaska wholesale average, was required to compile the Alaska wholesale average. And they went in on a voluntary basis, but because the processors had been turning in this information and the fact that they were used to dealing with the Department of Revenue and that feel for the Department of Revenue exists as a relatively high priority, they have literally every scanner in the state returned their form as of 3 weeks ago. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Blake. Mr. Kent Dawson.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Kent Dawson. I'm representing the United Fishermen of Alaska. One way to maybe think of the situation that we're facing with this bill would be to compare the wholesale salmon price and the use of that number to the consumer price index and how it is used with collective bargaining with the state. Both the union and in the state collective bargaining situation, the union and the state, the management side, both agree that the consumer price index is a fair evaluation of the effects of inflation, let's say, okay? And typically, the state and the unions will agree that they will abide by whatever that number works out to be out in the future because they trust the process that is involved in putting that number together and feel that it is an unbiased and objective figure, okay? Over the past 15 years, or longer, fishery organizations and processors have used the wholesale salmon price in the same manner. Because of a change in the way the state tax is collected during the last session, they're suddenly left without this number that everyone has been relying on. Okay, so that's one way to look at the situation. To answer your question, I think someone asked the question earlier about the penalty. The Department of Revenue suggested this very wording to resolve that problem. So the wording that you see there was suggested by the Department of Revenue. Okay. In answer to another question, I think Senator Sergiulewski had to ask about other species. At this time, we are taking a look at the possibility of adding other species and other forms of processing to this. We've been talking to the people in the House about this and are trying to put together a substitute that might meet that requirement. We would ask, however, that this committee consider moving this bill out as soon as possible, since if those negotiations fall through, we're really concerned about the effect on the Bristol Bay negotiations. And I think to explain what Mr. Blake meant by the effect on the Bristol Bay negotiations, the negotiations this year would probably are likely to involve selecting a number out in the future that everyone can agree that they will abide by, somewhat similar to the state labor negotiations. If they do not have a number that they can agree on, this will cause a tremendous problem in negotiations from the outset that could be a very, you know, it could lead to some the disagreements right into the fishing season or whatever, could be a devastating situation. So that's the one reason we asked that you expedite this. We do not oppose adding other species. The Department of Fish and Game currently requires the same information has for a number of years for all species. They have just not been collecting it, not enforcing it. We're trying to work out a system that would do away with one or the other, okay? And I think we would prefer, United Fishermen of Alaska would prefer that the Revenue Department collected the information since the enforcement of it is likely to be much more real and information to be in a much more timely manner. But Fish and Game has no problem with doing away with their side of the report to lessen the burden of the processors. So we are trying to work on that.
Any questions of Mr. Dawson? Thank you very much, Ken, for enlightening us on this. I had some questions too, but I think you've answered them all. So if there are no further questions, I think we need to make an amendment. Do I have a motion for amendment?
Mr. Chairman, I'd move that we amend Senate Bill number 346 and have a committee substitute for the bill to incorporate language that is in committee substitute for 773 on the second page, line 6, down to 7B.
Line 3.
Line 3 through 17.
Any objections? No objections? So ordered.
Kent, why is it coming back? Why is the information coming to the legislature? I could see from the processor's point of view that they're going to be concerned that they're, you know, it's a competitive business world out there among several processors, and they're going to be concerned that their costs are knowledgeable to the other processors. You know, so they're not just presenting one big fat $2.68 wholesale price. But, you know, you're going into label and labeling cost, transportation and storage cost, interest paid. That's a great deal of information to give away to a competitor. Why does that information have to become public by coming to the legislature, and was it handled this way previously?
Okay, the reason the information is required in that detail previously had to do with the tax law, okay? Now that information would be really only a benefit to fish and game and that kind of detail. The report that the Department of Revenue would generate after this process is done would not include that information. It would be under the confidentiality statute of the Department of Revenue. It would be simply a statewide number. You'd have no way of tracing it down to any particular firm or plant. So highly confidential. Only a number comes out the other end that is made public. Mm-hmm.
Any other questions for Mr. Dawson? Well, that's the extent of the people to testify on 346. At this point, I'd better check and see if somebody in the networks. Is there anyone at any network that wishes to testify on Senate Bill 346? Over.
Senate Bill 346.
Is that Mr. Hank Ostrowski, Barbara? Over.
Mr. Chairman, this is Dorothy in Dillingham. There may have been two of us talking at one time here. I do have Truman Emberg here with the Western Alaska Marketing Association who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 346.
Okay, go ahead. Okay, go ahead, Mr. Emberg. Over.
Mr. Chairman, Senators, after the presentation that you had to this point, I don't have much additional comment to give on this. I am a business manager for an association here, which represents some 350 Crystal Bay fishermen. I think the state should continue to publish this information. It gives very valuable information to us in the process of negotiations. And I'll conclude by saying that we support the gentlemen who have previously spoken to you. Over.
Thank you very much, Mr. Emberg. Any questions of Mr. Emberg? No questions. Then we have at Kodiak, shall I read this, Mr. Hardy. Mary Jo, do you have someone at Kodiak? Over.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I also like to speak for the Kodiak Fisherman Marketing Association. The board met today and supported Bill 346, and they asked me to go up here and speak to your committee. Blake pretty well told the story as well as Mr. Dawson. I have heard that the industry was against this bill, but I since then talked to Vice President of New England Fish Company in charge of Alaska, And it was my telephone that he told me that he would favor Bill 346 and he would get in touch with the lobbies in Juneau. And I just want to add something to this law. We used it for a number of years here in Kodiak, and it seemed to me it worked very well. It gets us fishing. When the fish are there and they bite and they should be caught, we get out fishing, and it's kind of a joint venture with the processor. If you don't get fishing and you're tied up in a spike, you get poor quality fish, dark skinned fish, and so forth that we call them inside the marvelous in many cases because we've been sitting in the spike. And I also figure there might be some other solution for the Bristol Bay problem. That's all I have, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Mr. Harder. Any questions for the membership of Mr. Harder? Cordier. No questions, Mr. Harder. Thank you very much. Now we'll get back to Anchorage again. Barbara, do you have someone there?
Yes, we do.
Go ahead,
please. My name is Les Bertner, and I'm representing myself as an independent businessman, and in part, Alaska Independent Fishermen's Marketing Association, of which I am a member. I commercial fish in Bristol Bay for a living. And I want to go on record as being in favor of Senate Bill 346. Simply stated, the passage of this bill will enable me to have access to information, which otherwise I wouldn't be able to obtain, or would be too expensive to obtain. This information will allow me an opportunity to assess the worth of the salmon I catch, and will allow me an opportunity to determine the equitable position between salmon processors and Fishermen's Association. Thank you. That concludes my statement.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bertner. Any questions of Mr. Bertner? No questions, Mr. Bertner. Thank you very much. Do we have anyone else in Anchorage? Barbara, over.
Yes, this is Hank Ostrowski, commercial fisherman, testifying for myself. I'd like to go on record in favor of this Senate Bill 346 and perhaps get a little bit more enlightenment that maybe it doesn't go far enough. You get into the real world of marketing, we found out that some of these wholesale prices that are quoted out of the pink sheet are just a figment of somebody's imagination. But when you get down and you talk to the large buyers and the chain stores, and then you price the salmon all the way back, actually from the consumer to these buyers, and then all the way through, and using certain profiles of the various sections as the salmon proceeds from the producer all the way to the consumer, you find that sometimes that there's a large discrepancy in what is stated and what actually occurs in the market. And I think that there is probably enough state expertise and economists, and probably that with the National Marine Fisheries doing some of the research, that we can start getting some realistic figures as far as what are the prices. For instance, last year we were in Michigan City, and we sat down with a buyer who wanted to buy salmon. And after he agreed to purchase the salmon, he costed it back and showed where there was about a $17 case enhancement over and above which could be recognized. And this, by the way, I think is a matter for an investigation by the Road Committee, because that information was turned over to that committee. And perhaps what we're looking at is some artificial enhancements of these prices. And there was an article in editorial in Anchorage Times of February 10, 1980, in which this was alluded to. And it said there, and I will quote out the context here, it says, there are those who suspect a conspiracy among packers has deliberately withheld the salmon from market. The purpose would be to hold it that so that 1980 prices would be depressed. As soon as the 1980 prices are accepted by the fishermen, it is speculated that packers will dispose of the 1979 pack with alacrity, probably in Southeast Asia or elsewhere in the Orient. There is more substance than fancy in that statement.
And I think an investigation, a full-scale investigation into the pricing of particularly salmon, probably crab, would maybe return to the fishermen in Alaska a tremendous amount of revenue, and to the state based on those new and more realistic figures. And we were also looking at the price of salmon, fresh and fresh frozen. We know that this is a run that is projected this year is going to have a tremendous effect, and it will have a tendency to depress prices unless there's some aggressive marketing done on the other end. I know this isn't quite germane to this bill, but I noticed that one of the people testified to the fact that the depressed prices that they figure were coming out of Bristol Bay. Well, we've been doing some marketing analysis there and some phone calls into Tokyo and also into Washington, D.C. There was no depression of the salmon price between $7 and $14 a pound, and there is actually a shortage of good salmon on the market. There's a lot of contaminated salmon, fresh and fresh frozen, and which are now being canned, but there is a definite shortage of good salmon in the markets, and perhaps if along with some of this we're looking at the wholesale prices, and if there is any increase of, say, revenue to the fishermen, this could probably be put into equipment that would increase the quality and the quality control of the salmon, and then we would all benefit as fishermen and as citizens in the state. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Hank. Any questions on Mr. Ostrowski? No questions, Hank, and thank you very much. Does any network have anyone else to testify on Senate Bill 346? Over. I assume not. And thank you very much. I noticed one thing here, Mr. Ferguson. The change in title, too. So I think we'll have to make a committee substitute in extend the title. Okay. You agree to that?
No.
All right, we'll make a committee substitute.
Mr. Chairman, I'd move that we move out committee substitute for Senate Bill number 346. The committee substitute will have a title change and will correspond with committee substitute for House Bill number 773 on page 2 from line 3 to line 17. And I'd move that we move that out with due pass recommendation.
Any objection? Any objection? No objections? So ordered.
Can you bring up the guard bills?
Beg your pardon?
We can bring up the guard bills.
Yes, you got that extra information there, I guess. Ken Humphrey's here to testify. And that's it.
Uh-huh. What about the collection agency?
Yeah, we got a couple people to testify.
All this time?
Okay. Fine. I'm going to read my notes here. Now we'll go back to Senate Bills 404 and 405. And Mr. Ken Humphreys, Ken will take your testimony there. And if we have to hold it over, we will, but I don't know how much you can lighten us. We'll find out shortly. Before you came in, we telecopied down some information that we'd gotten from your division to General McCrasson and Mr. Compton, the Department of Military Affairs. I have no idea whether they've gotten it yet or not, and if so, they probably haven't had time to peruse it and understand it, so we'll probably have to carry it over. I hate to do that, but when the squeeze, meet our deadlines. But go ahead and testify, and we'll decide what we'll do.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Ken Humphreys. I'm Deputy Director of the Division of Retirement Benefits.
I don't know.
Comments that I have on these two bills, Senate Bills 404 and 405, were brief and fairly general in nature, referring to the letter of March 7th, which Paul Arnold sent over to you. What Mr. Arnold was addressing in that letter, really more than the substance of the bills 404 and 405, which could probably be better spoken to by the Department of Military Affairs. The Department of Administration really takes no position on the benefit increase. That would be spoken to by the Department of Military Affairs. Our comments in the letter were general and related to the funding of the National Guard system. As you're probably aware, it's on a pay-as-you-go basis. Briefly, what we felt was that it should be put on a funded basis, like the public employees retirement system is, and like the teacher system is. We felt that it would increase the credibility and integrity of the system to ensure that money was there to fund the benefits if we found ourselves in a financially poor year. Essentially, it wouldn't change the cost of the system at all. It wouldn't affect the benefits that are paid. All it does is influence the way in which money is paid into the system. It would actually establish an account, and the legislature would continue to appropriate money to the system each year, but rather the amount would reflect the liabilities as they were being accrued rather than as they're falling due. The actuary would make an evaluation of that system, determine both the past and future service liability as he now does with the PERS system. And whereas that contribution rate is expressed as a percentage of payroll, what we visualized with the National Guard system is that the contribution would be expressed in dollars and that this information would be passed along to the Department of Military Affairs, and they would then request that amount in their appropriation.
Question.
Yes, sir.
Go ahead, I'll wait to you.
And one further comment. It was our intention that to suggest this type of a general change in the system, and to that end we forwarded along some suggested draft legislation. But I think it is not important that it necessarily be included in Senate Bills 404 or 405. They were a possible vehicle for such changes, but they do not relate, as I say, necessarily to the particular subject matter of those bills, but rather to the National Guard retirement system generally.
Okay, one approach, of course, would be if we were so inclined to pass 404 this year and then try to come in and establish this retirement plan next year.
Yes.
Because we are running out of time.
Yes.
You know, we'll probably be here another 10, 12 days.
That long?
I could imagine this bill having a problem getting through establishing an entirely new retirement system this year. I like the idea, though, because I think in the long term, not only will it be more fiscally sound, but I think there'll probably be a greater benefit establishment in the long term than simply the $100 a month thing. But do you envision the National Guard retirement system as being fully funded by the Department of Military Affairs?
Yes.
You envision it that way?
In the same way that the appropriation goes to them now, it would be transferred into the fund. Along the lines that we've suggested, it would be set up rather than being a part of PERS as it is now as a separate retirement system. The benefits are really not parallel. We feel a little awkward with it the way it is now, since it's supposedly administered as a part of and in like manner to the PERS, when in fact our only involvement with it the way it is currently administered is to issue these personnel actions, which starts the benefits being paid, and we really had no further involvement with it. We don't really know what the liabilities are, and are not really actively engaged in administering the system at all.
Mr. Kennedy.
Mr. Lee.
Ken, I funding this system with, I assume, some vesting capabilities, would this then come under ERISA as a, would it be considered a pension plan? Would we be creating another problem?
No, I do not think so. The changes that the system is already established. Public plans are not subject to ERISA anyway. The PERS is not. Now, as you're aware, I'm sure Congress is considering PERISA, and they may subject all public plans to such a thing. But my suggestion to you along those lines is that going ahead and taking some steps to put it on a funded basis would be getting started on something that I think ultimately many public plans are going to be forced to do anyway. It's good business practice, and doesn't really affect the cost of the system at all, except for a relatively small amount that you would pay the actuary to make the evaluation. It's independent of the benefit structure that you establish, is what I'm getting at.
Thank you.
Sure.
One other question.
Yes, sir.
Have you got any idea now how much we're paying per year under the $50 a month?
I do not. I'm sure that Mr. Roundtree could give you that information.
Okay, as for FY81, under the present system, we may pay at $87,000. That's what we're budgeting for FY81. I don't have FY80 present right here with me. We're adding about 15 in a year, so it would be a little bit less than that.
Yeah, no, that'd pick up.
The reason it was more than double for FY81 is that we are picking up some of these poor fellows that just fall through the cracks on the thing. See, the way it is right now,
Mr. Ramsey.
Okay.
Yeah, I think it might be better. Just pull a chair up there, if you will. Dick.
You may be... Okay. I'm Dick Roundtree, admin officer at Department of Military Affairs.
Okay. Go ahead, Dick.
At this time, the $50 a month, to be eligible for that, a member has to be standing in ranks at age 55. Most of these people join when they're about 18 years old. So as it stands now, to be eligible, the age and time criteria, he'd have to have about 37 years of service and be standing in ranks and be counted, and then retire at age 55. Okay, as you may know, one of the changes in here would be to take that age limit off completely, and it'd be the 20-year of satisfactory service the spec on that at this time. I mean, at what is proposed, okay. So that's the reason that if you have the copy of the fiscal note there, why it does jump up considerably at that point. What is on our fiscal note, on the front of our fiscal note, is the net effect of if this was implemented. For FY81, it would be 124.2. And that would be over and above the present 87,000 that we would have in fund. Also say that since talking to Cam about their proposed amendment, which we neither had ever seen till today, what we can determine out of it, what Ken tells me, would only enhance the integrity of the fund, which we would think would be good. And, right now we're sort of budgeting every year for this, and we're being our own actuaries. And so far, we've done quite well with it. But as the thing grows, we feel we would need that expertise.
Right. That would take quite a committee substitute to work that out, and I don't think we can do it right now, but I think we can have it done in the interim, make it up the next meeting.
Yeah, that would be my judgment,
and
too.
We'll work with you on that.
That would certainly suit our purposes.
Ken,
and,
I agree, Dick, would increase the integrity. And
our intent
would
certainly
back.
not to bog these bills down particularly, but to raise a concern that I think is important now, and as Dick indicated, as these systems grow, will become not only increasingly important, but increasingly difficult to do it.
That's right. Under your system, I think we can do it better.
So,
increase it as time goes.
A separate approach would be more than acceptable to us.
You need to offer a decent incentive to keep people in this sort of thing, giving up their weekends and this sort of thing for their families.
Are we going to take action on this bill today, the both of us?
I really don't know all that needs to be included in it. I'd like
there's
to.
One thing I
wanna,
there's one thing
the
I want
to
check in the bill. In general, of course, I'm going to support the bill. The one problem area I see is the 5-year service in the Alaska National Guard. I think perhaps, with all deference to my friends out in the Guard, that maybe we should consider raising that a little bit to make sure that we stimulate more participation. 5 years isn't even a minimum obligatory period, and I just don't understand why we're doing it this way.
You know, we did that to loan bill, in that they had a lot of territorial guardsmen that had a 5-year tour. And I got, I guess, about 12 letters. I don't know how many we have in the state. Maybe you know, Dick. That, like Carl Hahn, for instance, you know, and so on, couldn't get in the Veterans Loan Program. 5 years, 6 years. So we dropped it to 5 to pick up
right.
The old times.
Yeah, but this is different.
This is different.
The object, the real justification for this is not recruiting, but retention. 18-year-old kids don't worry about retirement benefits, So we're talking about the 35, 38-year-old staff sergeant who's got 6 years in the Air Force and he's got another 6 years in the Guards. He's looking at 12 years, which is what I have, when I got out.
Right.
And then he's thinking, should I go on for my 20? Or the guy that put 10 in, and it just, I don't know if five years in the Guard is... And I'll bow to whoever wrote the bill up, but I just want to make sure that the 5 years is the most stimulating number of years we can come up with in order to encourage retention. I want to find out who came up with the 5-year figure, but other than that, I'm full speed ahead.
Well, 5 years vested time is sort of standard for most of the retirement plans, isn't it? Before you can get in it?
Well, I don't know if I'd go quite that far. It certainly is the vesting period in the PDRS, but for example, in the teacher system, it's 8.
Yeah.
And in very many of the other public systems around the country, other state systems, it's as long as 10.
Yeah, and you have to have, before you can get credit for your military service, you have to have 5
right.
Vested time.
Yeah, you must be vested.
Right.
But we're
it's
not
talking. Standard.
We're not talking. Well, I guess.
It's different, I grant you, but. Somewhat related.
Because you still have to have a total of 20.
Mm-hmm.
But only 5 of them have to be in the Guard. But my question is going to be, why only 5? Wouldn't we get more retention out of it if we move that up a couple of years? But then,
Yeah, it's a different situation. I could go either way. I just don't know. You suppose it might discourage you some from getting in at all.
Excuse me, Senator.